I'm scared that someone will come into my school and kill me or my two younger sisters or my friends with weapons that they should not possess.
State lawmakers hear testimony on a new gun control proposal. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, will oil production disrupt migratory birds in the National Petroleum Reserve?
I think we don't want to jump to the conclusion that, oh, industrial disturbance doesn't affect birds in any way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting starting at 10 a.m. on March 5th and 9 a.m. on March 6th at the Nome Mini Convention Center. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
A proposed House bill would allow Alaska judges to issue protective orders removing guns from people who they find to likely be a threat to themselves or others. In a Judiciary Committee meeting today, House Bill 75 received backing from the public. 29 of the first 30 people who testified on the bill said they support it as a way of preventing suicides and homicides. Juno Douglas High School sophomore Stella Tolman says she was inspired by the activism of the victims of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooting in Parkland, Florida, to testify in favor of the bill.
As an American, I should not feel scared to come to school, but I am scared. I'm scared that someone will come into my school and kill me or my two younger sisters or my friends with weapons that they should not possess. So I urge you to vote yes, on House Bill 75, because we need stricter gun laws.
Bill sponsor Anchorage Democratic Representative Garen Tarr says she tried to help her own brother before he killed himself. She says other deaths using guns were often preceded by warning signs.
When we read about some of these stories, we know that family members have in fact been looking for something to do and wanting something, a tool to use. And I think this can be an important prevention tool.
Two groups of people could file petitions for gun violence protective orders, immediate family members and police and other peace officers. The person with the guns would be given at least 10 days notice of the hearing to decide on the order. If the judge finds clear and convincing evidence that the person is a danger, the judge could issue a protective order prohibiting the person from possessing, owning, buying, or receiving a firearm or ammunition for up to 6 months. Family members or police officers could also seek emergency orders that don't include the person with the guns in a hearing. If the judge finds there's a greater than 50% chance the person could harm themselves or others, the judge could issue an immediate emergency protective order that could last up to 20 days. Representative Gabrielle Ledoux is a Republican who caucuses with the mostly Democratic House majority. She questioned whether the bill would take away the gun rights of anyone with a diagnosis of clinical depression.
I think it would be kind of an incentive not to seek psychiatric help for depression.
Garen Tarr noted that mental health providers are not among those who could ask for the gun violence protective orders. The committee did not vote on the bill today. Students walked out of class today at Bethel Regional High School to raise awareness about school shootings and to demand stricter gun laws. Community members, parents, and former school staff joined them. The demonstration lasted 17 minutes, 1 minute for each person killed in the Parkland, Florida school shootings 2 weeks ago. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur was at the Bethel School when the walkout began.
To leave the building, you have to pass two pictures, a smiling young boy and a white-haired man. Sophomore Josh Palacios and Principal Ron Edwards were killed in the Bethel School shooting 21 years ago. Walking by, the students held handmade signs and wore orange ribbons as they made their way out into the snow. Bethel Regional High School isn't a place where a shooting could happen. It's a place where people hope it doesn't happen again.
Kids do not need to go to school in fear of their lives. Teachers don't need to be holding weapons, and everyone deserves to be safe and educated.
Bethel senior Kelly O'Brien organized the walkout. Class president Tierney McCormick stood by her side and addressed the approximately 100 students who walked out with them.
This is also our first step. Unless we continue to push for change, nothing's going to happen. So it's really up to you to make sure that we keep pushing.
When I seen that on the news, what happened in Florida, it brought up Bethel, what happened here in Bethel to me. It all came back.
Garrett Lieb was working at the Bethel school during the 1997 Bethel shooting, and he hid kids who were running for their lives in a warehouse beside the building. Now his daughter goes to school there, and he wants semi-automatic rifles banned.
Those are killing machines. Those ain't, you know, we got guns to get our moose and our caribou and stuff like that, but nobody needs guns like that out anywhere.
Renee Athanas was also working at the Bethel School in 1997. She urged students to write letters demanding gun reform and handed out the addresses and phone numbers of Alaska's congressional delegation.
They might not think you can vote now, but you will vote one day.
So let's all have a moment of silence for not only the Parkland shooting victims, but the shooting victims from our school and all the other shooting victims across the U.S.
At the Bethel Regional High School, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Every summer, millions of migratory birds descend on Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve to lay eggs, molt their feathers, and fatten up. Now, a new neighbor is edging in on the birds' territory, the oil industry. So scientists are trying to figure out how more oil rigs in the reserve might affect migratory birds. One recent study on this topic resulted in a few surprises. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
Here's a drama in three acts. The year? 2013. The setting? A marshy patch of brown grass in Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve. And there in the middle is a nesting greater white-fronted goose.
The female's present, she's incubating.
That's Brant Meixel, a researcher with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's narrating a series of photos taken by a camera set up about 20 feet from the goose's nest. And for a while, not much happens. The goose just sits on her eggs. But then comes the second act.
And all of a sudden, here's an Arctic fox.
A small, fuzzy white fox approaches the nest, and Mama Goose springs into action.
Upright, wings spread, mouth open, very aggressive. She actually looks quite mean.
But as the next photo shows, not mean enough to deter Mr. Fox.
The fox has its tail almost tucked between its legs and its ears back, but it's not willing to give up. And in the next photo, the fox is turning and it's circling the goose, and the goose is getting even crazier, and she's turning sideways and flapping her wings.
The tangle intensifies. In the next photo, you can see the fox baring its teeth as the goose flaps her wings just above its head. Finally, Act 3. The mother goose's aggressive defense pays off, and the fox turns tail and leaves.
And then 1 minute later, she's back on her nest, relaxed, and it looks as though nothing happened.
The moral of the story? Mother geese do not like to leave their nests. Meixel says that's because they need to protect their eggs from foxes, gulls, and other Arctic opportunists.
To be honest, the predators know where every goose nest is.
So what happens if a new character enters the scene? The oil industry. Oil companies have started to see a lot of potential in the National Petroleum Reserve, and a lot of that oil potential lies squarely in migratory goose habitat. That's why Meixel and his colleagues wanted to study if industrial activity would drive geese away from their nests more often, or for longer, leaving their eggs vulnerable to hungry predators. A perfect opportunity to investigate came up about 5 years ago. There was a cleanup of an old Air Force radar station in the Petroleum Reserve. It involved a lot of noisy machinery.
Vehicle traffic, heavy equipment, regular aircraft, fixed-wing and helicopter activity.
All things that seem likely to spook a greater white-fronted goose. So Meixel set up cameras near several hundred nests, at nests near the cleanup, and at nests a few kilometers away for comparison.
And so we were able to collect a very large number of photographs of nests.
Over 3 million photos, to be exact. And those photos told a surprising story. Meixel shows me a particularly striking example.
Here's a photo where there's a female goose and a DC-6 is landing on the runway just about 5 meters from the nest.
A DC-6 is a plane, a really big plane. And in this photo, the plane's wing is about to pass right above the nesting goose. And amazingly, she stays put.
She certainly notices it, and makes the decision to remain and protect her eggs.
Mikesell and his colleagues collected photo after photo of white-fronted geese staying on their nests as planes flew by, backhoes dug up holes, and helicopters buzzed overhead. In the end, the scientists concluded that nearby industrial activity only had a minor effect. The geese close to the noisy cleanup did leave their nests for a few minutes longer each day on average, but it didn't result in a lot more eggs getting munched up by predators. In fact, the thing that had the biggest impact were the researchers. When they walked directly up to the nests to check on them, that's when the geese left the longest. So I asked Mikesell, does this mean the oil industry can go ahead and drill and the geese will be fine?
Of course, as a scientist, I'm going to say that it's much more complicated than that.
Mikesell stresses this is one study about one species of goose at one specific stage of its life cycle. In other words, there's still a lot we don't know. Audrey Taylor agrees. She's a migratory bird researcher at University of Alaska Anchorage who wasn't involved in the research.
I think we don't want to jump to the conclusion that, oh, industrial disturbance doesn't affect birds in any way.
Taylor says the study spells out some important lessons for oil companies. For one, it shows it's a good idea to avoid walking directly up to nesting geese. But she says there are still questions about how the oil industry could impact migratory birds in the National Petroleum Reserve. For example, what happens if there's industrial activity while the geese are molting? Every year, geese take refuge in the reserve while they shed and regrow their flight feathers.
Activity or disturbance during that time could certainly have a bigger effect because they're going to be running away from it rather than flying.
Taylor says that as the oil industry pushes further into the habitats of mother geese, foxes, and all the other species living in the reserve, studies like this one are becoming a lot more important. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, as mushers prepare for the Iditarod start, the great race is mired in controversy.
There is part of this race that is a cancer right now. There is a corruption in this race.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A 39-year-old Ketchikan man was buried in an avalanche while snowboarding on Dude Mountain on Sunday afternoon. A search began on Monday but has been temporarily suspended because of bad weather. Jerry Kiefer is with the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad. He says two snowboarders hiked up to the summit area of the mountain. They were snowboarding when the avalanche was triggered at about noon.
One person was buried, presumed to have been buried. The other one used his avalanche beacon, was able to get a signal from the other person, dug for about an hour and a half, wasn't able to locate him, and then without cell signal or any way to contact help, he came back down the mountain to get help.
Kiefer says KVRS was notified at about 5 p.m. At that point, he says it was too dark to start a recovery effort. They had hoped to launch a helicopter on Monday, but weather prevented them from getting close. Kiefer says crews skied and snowshoed to the site instead. At around noon, they were testing the snow to see whether it was safe to search. In an interview later on Monday, Chris John of KVRS said the snow conditions were extremely dangerous and crews could not search thoroughly. They looked as best they could from stable areas on the mountain and didn't see any sign. The wind was blowing about 50 miles per hour on top of the mountain, and recovery crews were recalled mid-afternoon. John says they will try again when the weather improves, which could be Thursday or Friday. According to Alaska State Troopers online dispatch, the name of the man is Marvin Scott. Next of kin have been notified. The National Park Service is considering new rules for the disposal of human waste generated by climbers on North America's tallest mountain, Denali. Rules for waste are serious on the Alaska Mountain because all water comes from melted snow and contamination can lead to diarrhea and life-threatening dehydration. Climbers above a base camp at 7,200 feet are allowed to deposit human waste into deep crevasses. However, a researcher has determined that bacteria in much of the waste is not killed because it's not exposed to extreme temperatures or ultraviolet light. Proposed rules would require climbers to deposit human waste in one of two places: a crevasse high on the mountain where it's likely to be rendered inert, or at a ranger station in Talkeetna where climbers land after flying off the mountain. The Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race kicks off this Saturday as mushers and their dogs cross 1,000 miles of the Alaska wilderness. But as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, this year the event is mired in scandals that are putting its future in jeopardy.
Every March, the streets of downtown Anchorage fill with hundreds of sled dogs and mushing fans outfitted in their finest furs. Then, competitors set out on the grueling journey over snowy mountains, icy rivers, and frozen tundra toward the town of Nome on the Bering Sea coast. But this year's race is up against extra challenges, as multiple controversies have crashed down all at once, even driving one of its stars to post a 17-minute-long YouTube video lashing out at race leadership.
The Iditarod can try to run me over, they can try to throw me under the bus, but I'm going to be honest to myself, and they're going to find out I don't fit under the bus.
Dallas Seavey is a mushing wunderkind, having won the race 4 times before age 30. But since last fall, he's been embroiled in the sport's first high-profile doping scandal after it came out that some of his dogs tested positive for a banned painkiller at the end of last year's race. Seavey vigorously denies that he drugged his team and was backed up by other notable mushers. He's faulted the Iditarod's board of directors for mishandling the investigation, hurting his reputation in the process.
There is part of this race that is a cancer right now. There is a corruption in this race.
Seavey snubbed this year's Iditarod and is competing in a Norwegian race that runs at the same time. He's also pushed back on the damning doping narrative by hiring a public relations firm, casting doubt on scientific results from the Iditarod Trail Committee, and aggressively defended his record in the press.
I believe this was given to my dogs maliciously, as that's one of the options. I think that's the most likely option.
The theory that a saboteur drugged Seavey's dogs is accepted by many in Alaska's mushing community. Some believe it could have been an accident or mistake. Some think it might have been a competitor. And others point to animal rights activists who have done more in recent years to take down the Iditarod's public image. Leading that charge is PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. The group says it did not have any personnel in Alaska last year and condemns dogs being given banned substances. But Colleen O'Brien, a vice president for communications, says PETA is leaning harder than ever on corporate sponsors to drop their support for the event.
One of the biggest lies that the Iditarod community has tried to sell the public is that these dogs aren't like the dogs we share our homes with, and it's not true.
PETA wants for the Iditarod to become a race without dogs, saying mushing is fundamentally abusive. The group claims that sponsor flight is taking a toll on the Iditarod's financial health, and for the first time ever, they're sending protesters to Alaska for this year's race, with demonstrations planned in Anchorage, Willow, and the finish in Nome. On top of all of that, earlier in February, a prominent group of race veterans within the Iditarod Official Finishers Club called for the president of the board of directors to resign immediately, alleging his mismanagement and conflicts of interest are jeopardizing the whole sport. The demand came on the heels of a confidential report by the Foraker Group that was commissioned by the race's main sponsors and leaked to the press. It pointed to many of the same problems, saying the board needs major reforms for companies to keep financing it. Andy Baker is the board president and brother to Iditarod champion John Baker. Following a closed-door meeting, his fellow board members voted unanimously to leave him at the helm for the time being. Afterwards, Baker spoke to reporters.
Everybody wants the race to do better, and the board, our whole focus is we want to have a safe race. We want dogs to be safe. We want mushers to be safe. And we want a successful race that's good for Alaska.
Baker says the board is planning to revise its governing rules in the spring, once this year's race is over. That opens the door for reforming leadership practices that have been criticized by the Finishers Club and Foraker Report. Many are pining for the old days, when the Iditarod was more like a weeks-long wilderness adventure than a race. Stan Hooley, Iditarod's CEO, sympathizes.
There's a big part of me that that feels that way, too. Unfortunately, I'm in the business and in the role of working to grow this race.
Some people say that means it's not as fun, that the race doesn't resemble the statewide celebration it used to. But others say the global audience and increase in corporate money that it's drawn could be what carries the Iditarod and dog mushing on into the future. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And if you want more news on all things mushing, you can subscribe to the Iditapod, a podcast about the Iditarod from Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio. You can find it on our website, subscribe to iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating more than 40 years of Alaska operations.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. Find out how you can include a gift to your public radio station through estate planning. Ask your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
A satellite scheduled for launch tomorrow will aid weather forecasting in the western U.S., including Alaska. According to NASA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, GOES, or Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellite, is the second new unit to be deployed into orbit over the equator. The first of the new minivan-sized satellites positioned to view eastern North America went up in 2016, replacing an older model. NASA says the satellites send images and other data to Earth five times faster than predecessor versions.
As high as a picture every 1 minute, which is incredible compared to what we've seen before.
National Weather Service meteorologist Becca Mazur in Fairbanks says the higher transmission speeds help forecasters do their job.
You can actually use the satellite imagery now. You can use it for forecast at the moment instead of having to wait 15 plus minutes for the picture to show up.
The new satellites also offer four times better image resolution. Finer detail, Mazur says, is key to observation and forecasting.
It's a significant improvement for observing clouds and other weather patterns.
To discern between snow, ice, and cloud cover.
Lisa Wirth is interim director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geographic Information Network of Alaska, or GINA, which has NASA contracts to download and process data from similarly equipped polar orbiting satellites. Wirth points to the technology's value in quickly tracking weather, as well as a range of other environmental conditions.
Sea ice, wildfire, volcanic emissions.
Near real-time tracking of conditions is important for public safety, capability worth credits to a general growth in space-based Earth observation.
The number of satellites that are flying in space are increasing, and so that's just increasing our temporal coverage, which means we can get data faster, more often over the same spot on the Earth. And then, of course, the technology is also increasing, so we're getting better data in itself.
A rocket carrying the new GOES satellite is scheduled for liftoff from Cape Canaveral, Florida at 1:04 p.m. Alaska time tomorrow. More than 100 people turned out to Centennial Hall to observe, listen, and speak to state regulators reviewing the acquisition of Juneau's electric utility by a Canadian firm. KTOO's Jacob Resnick was there.
It was a community input session and fairly informal. Thane resident Steve Benke was one of about a dozen critics to speak. He asked the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to take testimony under oath because of the high stakes.
My gut tells me it's not a good idea for our local electric utility to be under the control of a big, distant, multinational corporation. I'm not convinced that people have thought through all the implications or the appropriate conditions for this merger.
The RCA can approve or deny the acquisition of Alaska Electric Light and Power's parent company. That parent company is Avista. It operates in 5 states, including Alaska. So approval is needed by each state for Hydro One of Ontario's expansion into the Pacific Northwest to move forward. In Alaska, the clock is ticking. A decision is due in late May. Staffers at the Public Utility Commission of Oregon recently recommended against approving the takeover of Avista's assets there. In Alaska, there's also been criticism. More than 100 public comments, most of them critical, have been received by the RCA. But there were a few supporters in the crowd. Neil McKinnon served on AEL&P's board of directors for 30 years. He read a letter by the former owner, Bill Corbis, that said the merger would help strengthen the company by adding financial power and technical expertise. McKinnon said the ownership of the utility isn't as important as long as it's managed properly.
Who cares? Who knows? As long as two things happen for the Juneau people. When you hit the switch, the lights come on, and when you get your bill, you don't panic. That's what's really important.
One of the biggest points of contention is the fate of Snettisham Hydroelectric Project. Built by the federal government and completed in the 1970s, it's owned by the state and leased to AEL&P, and it produces most of Juneau's electricity. Under a complex arrangement signed in the 1990s, AEL&P has an option to buy Snettisham at any time. That's led to concern in the community and among elected officials that a critical piece of infrastructure could end up in the hands of private interests. Hydro One executive Ferio Pugliese said Tuesday his company has no plans to leverage Snettisham for financial gain. Even before the RCA begins deliberations, it still has to set other ground rules. It's already said the Snettisham question is off the table, but what's not decided is whether the city and borough of Juneau will be allowed to intervene as a party to the process. Hydro One has offered some assurances over Snettisham if the city would withdraw its petition and support its buyout. That didn't happen. It's up to the RCA now to decide whether the city will be granted a seat at the table. In the meantime, the Juneau Assembly has allocated $75,000 for legal costs to make its case. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Finally tonight, a correction in a story last evening about a fuel spill at Port Williams on Shuyak Island. We incorrectly reported that the Port Williams seaplane base is owned by Ocean Beauty Seafoods. It is not. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Elizabeth Harball and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.